So, welcome everybody to another episode of Software Addict Home Stream, this time around with James Lewis. James, welcome to the show, and I'm really glad to have you here. And of course, again, it's live from the Software Architecture Gathering, so James did a session there today. James, do you want to say a few words about yourself?
Yeah, I can do. So, first of all, thank you very much for the invite. It's always great to see you. It's been a few years now, but you know, it's kind of good to see a friendly face from the conference scene. So hi everyone. I'm James Lewis. I work for ThoughtWorx. I guess my current title is technical director. I don't really know what that means. I do know it means I get sent a lot of emails asking about our SAP infrastructure and whether we need, or whether I'd like to buy the names of Salesforce customers off people. That seems to be what technical director means so far. I guess, you know, I'm a developer by background. I've been a Java developer for a long, long time. Joined ThoughtWorx 15 years ago as a developer. In that time, I've played most roles. I've been a tech lead, what we call an account tech principal. So that's, you know, more with responsibility across multiple teams and large programs of work. And then I suppose a few years ago, I sort of put a bunch of thoughts that have been swirling around mine and other people's heads, including actually Stefan Tilkoff, who was inspirational as well behind the idea of microservices because of his SOA background and REST background. And I put that down in some form that Martin and I published on Martin Fowler's site, which sort of kickstarted, I guess, what's become a bit of a almost like a revolution, really, in the way people build software, or a lot of organizations are building software or thinking about it. And since then, I've continued to, you know, muse on those topics. I've, I guess, become a bit more interested in the idea of teams and team structures and how they impact how we build software or how organizations get stuff done. And most recently, I've been sort of semi-obsessed with this idea of complexity science. So, So I guess that's me. Is that acceptable as an intro?
It's perfect. And as you said, we are so you can really be considered one of the microservices pioneers. And just before we started the stream, we also talked about sort of, so you were already talking about the microservices article on Martin Fowler's blog, which is, I guess, still one of the most cited sources of information about microservices and an overview. However, there is also that Java the Unix Way presentation that you did, I think, in Poland, and we just figured out that it's 8 years ago now, and that is probably the place where the inverse convoy maneuver was first talked about. I did a training the last few days, and of course yesterday I talked about that too, so that's one of the things that are also very fundamental to microservices. So what is the inverse convoy maneuver?
That's a great question. So I guess, where did this come from? So, I mean, I sort of got interested in the idea of, you know, of Conway's Law and reading about that probably in the late 2009-10, working with Dan North, really. You know, he's a great thinker, great intellectual around how not just software is built and designed and delivered, but also around how the socio political side of building software, then, you know, how teams are structured and how organizations work and that kind of thing. And he sort of pointed me at that, as well as a bunch of other stuff around flow and how to design product development team, you know, product development organizations for flow. And so I guess Conway's Law, the idea that I think probably everyone knows by now, but the idea that over time, the way that the communication structures of a team building software will be reflected in the software itself. So you know, this was, I think, 1968-9, Mel Conway came up with this or published a paper on this. The mirroring hypothesis, it was originally called, I think. And then over time, it sort of, you know, more and more research was done, which seemed to point to this, to the fact that it was, in fact, it was a real phenomenon. And then the idea, I guess, that, you know, I think for me, that Java the Unix Way presentation was really an experience report about a program of work I was on at the time, and about how we in ThoughtWorx took a very big problem, essentially, and tried to break it up into a way that we could deliver within an acceptable time frame for a client. And that meant that we needed multiple teams working in parallel, you know, which is, you know, from the off, it's not necessarily my ideal way of writing software, right? You know, there's a lot that can get done by five people, on a single team. But in this case, we did need to scale. And the problem when we broke it up really lent itself, when we sort of squinted a bit, to having multiple teams structured around different business capabilities. So and the idea being that, you know, if you have a team that is building one particular thing, and they're dedicated to that particular thing, then Conway's law, the inverse Conway maneuver, you know, build the team structure you want, the organization you want, and, you know, the architecture will follow kicking and screaming, was my colleague Evan Botch's description of the inverse Conway maneuver. So what we sort of thought was, if we've got, you know, we've got to build these business capabilities, we've got to build this software, it's got these capabilities, user management, you know, access management, IAM, you know, stuff. It's got fulfillment in there. It's got all these other things. Well, you know, let's organize teams around those capabilities. Let's have small teams, but building user management. So it's everything to do with creating users, managing user accounts and all that kind of thing. And that's really, for me, where that started. And that's where I talk a bit about that in Java, the Unix way. I think I was calling them micro applications at the time. Micro apps rather than microservices, which came a little bit later. But I mean, you know, I still think it's not just valuable but underused approach actually to building software and to structuring software. One of the, you know me, I do tend to have a habit of waffling, so just, I don't know, wave a card at me or shout or something. But one of the things I've been privileged to go to is a workshop at a guy called Dave Thomas, Badara Dave Thomas's place. Mm-hmm. And in one of those workshops, Mel Conway was actually there. He was invited as well. So I had the great, you know, privilege and pleasure of sitting down and talking about his work, his research at length with a number of others who, you know, are in the software architecture space, about the length, you know, what we've done with Conway's Law over the years. And I heard this, it was a really great story from Adrian Cockcroft, I'm sure he won't mind me telling it, where, you know, they deliberately designed their team structures in Netflix according to essentially the inverse Conway maneuver, down to where they sat in the building, you know. Because there's a whole bunch of research going back years and years. There's a guy called Thomas Allen who wrote a PhD thesis on the distance that people sitting from each other, you know, the effect of distance on knowledge work when people, you know, in some of the stuff that we do. I think it's something like six to seven meters, after which you've got zero probability, more or less, of having a serendipitous conversation, you know, which, you know, you put all this stuff together. Well, it means if you've got people you want to talk to each other a lot, you sit in close together, right? You know, so, which is another kind of Conway's Law kind of idea. So, you know, in Netflix's case, if you've got the UX, the UI folk who are building for multiple platforms all over the place, televisions, and we all know, then you sit them next to the platform API team, mm-hmm. right? The folk who are taking, you know, essentially they've got a big, it's like a big BFF in some senses. You sit those folk next to that because those are the people they need to talk to the most. They need to make requests for new features or new APIs or new fields in APIs or whatever it is. But they don't need to sit next to the people who are managing Cassandra, right? Because they don't really have much to do with Cassandra rings and you know, that kind of thing. So you sit those a long way away from them, you know, because they don't need to have that form of conversational change. I think we sort of talk about it as rather than having it as, you know, doing versioning and all this. So. I mean, so I think there's some really exciting things that you can actually do with it when you take it almost like reductio ad absurdum, you know, deliberately sit the people who you want to talk to each other next to each other and keep the others a long way away, you know. And it has impact on things like distribution of work, right? I mean, across the world, you know, when you're doing things like distributed delivery, quite common to have, you know, teams working across India, maybe the US, maybe the UK, maybe Germany, whatever it is. Don't have them working on the same capability, right? You know, have them working on things that are discrete, because geographical distance will enforce those architectural boundaries, you know, in a way that would be positive, or you would hope it's positive.
Mm-hmm. So I found two things quite interesting from what you just said. So one thing is that you were talking a lot about people should be sitting next to each other. So it's more like. In a way, what you're saying is the communication structure depends on whether people are sitting next to each other. So that's an interesting thing that I noted. And the other thing that I found interesting is that you said it's underused. So, and I thought that, I don't know, in my bubble, it seems that that there's a huge fuss and hype around Conway's law and how it influenced everything. So I thought that was interesting. Having said that, what would you do differently now? I mean, 8 years have passed, so and you said it's underused. So would your advice be to do the inverse Conway maneuver and use it more frequently, or is there anything else that you think should be done differently nowadays, or maybe it shouldn't be done at all nowadays? So what do you think?
That's a great question. I mean, what would I do differently? I mean, all you people watching out there, just before, you know, raising the curtain a bit on this, just beforehand, we were talking a little bit about Warhammer 40,000. There's a great thing in Warhammer 40,000 around, you know, the kind of the intro to it is about that all the technology that's been lost, never to be refound, and all this kind of thing, like the Dark Ages. And I do think in some senses, as an industry, we have to relearn everything over and over again. We're a bit like the Dark Age of the Imperium in the sense that we have to relearn all the time. And actually looking back at that presentation, thinking back at the things we were doing on that team and that program, I think actually a lot of it, we're not doing a lot of that stuff anymore, or certainly I don't see it. I don't see that it's become the de facto way of developing software. So, you know, we talked about Conway's Law, you have the team structure. Well, how do the teams talk to each other? What structure do you put in terms of the APIs between teams? And I don't know, maybe this is just me, and maybe this is just the organizations I've been working with, but I don't tend to see a lot of organizations thinking about things like domain application protocols, or thinking about, you know, minimizing cognitive load in terms of the APIs they're developing, you know, choosing something like we did back then with Atom and Atom Pub, because it's a consistent way that all the teams can speak with one another. You know, these days, I don't know about you, but I still hearken after the days of XML. You know, I used to like XML. You know, but hey, Jason seemed to win. And we have to tunnel XML through Jason now, which is kind of frustrating. But you know, looking back, I think there's a lot of things that, because it's not just sit teams next to each other or sit teams further away. It's how are those the interfaces between those teams going to work? What thoughts do you have to put into API design? What thoughts do you need to put into evolution of APIs? Those sorts of things, which come together with Conway's Law, I think. You know, they're sort of additive, in a sense. And that's why I sort of think about a little bit about the microservices idea. We talked about, smarts in the endpoints, not in the pipes. That's kind of what we were talking about. You know, being considerate about how you interacted via software with other parts of your organization. And it seems very much that we seem to have jumped on everything is swagger now, right? As long as we've got a swagger, that's fine, we're done. You know, actually, that's not a domain application protocol, right? That's just a swagger definition, but yeah.
So I think that's a very good point. And to me, it seems nowadays that we are basically relearning modularization in a way with microservices. One thing that is sort of a good, I think, almost an obvious question. So you said you should sit, people who are working together on one thing should sit next to one another. With the corona pandemic, obviously, that's not really a choice. So what's your advice for all the remote work that we have nowadays? What is the equivalent of setting people next to each other and having them share a room? So what's your advice there?
Yeah, that's the one thing I think. I mean, you talk to anyone who's writing software at the moment, it's the one thing that we all wish we could do, right? We're getting a huge amount of benefit from having this ability to maintain more of a work-life balance, to work when we want, where we want, this kind of stuff. But I think we all recognize we've lost something. We've lost, even if you can use an electronic whiteboard to sketch some ideas quickly, or even if Slack now has a mechanism for very quickly jumping into a video call with your teammates, you know, that doesn't compensate for those, you know, the overheard someone behind you saying, oh, I've got this terrible problem with this particular login framework. And well, I had that problem 3 weeks ago. I can help you with that. You know, that we've lost a lot of that. In terms of my advice, I mean, so we still do things like we still pair program a lot in ThoughtWorks. That's pretty much de facto a sensible default for all our teams. So we've had to discover ways of making that much more effective than we have done previously, making sure that, you know, like Zoom burnout is a thing and Zoom pair programming burnout is like a real, real thing, right? You know, so how do you manage that? How do you manage, you know, being more diligent about core pairing hours, for example? You know, it's taken us a while to realize that you can replicate the sort of things you would have in a team room, but in the virtual world. So I'm not just talking about a Trello board or Jira board or whatever. I mean, the sort of board you would see on an InnoQ project or on a ThoughtWorks project or an Agile project, where you've got, it's not just swim lanes with work in it. It's avatars of people on them. It's who's off on holiday. It's the quotes. It's the, you know, it's the team charter and all those things that you need to be able to see, I think, which makes a team a cohesive whole as opposed to being a group of individuals. You know, open source is a fantastic way of building software, clearly, but it's not the perfect way of building software. Otherwise, we would have all found this a long time ago, you know? So, you know, my advice would be to you know, don't settle maybe for the tooling that's there. Put some effort into recreating the things that you valued previously. And if the things you valued previously were, you know, I remember like that Java the Unix way project, for example, we were heavily, it was level 3, Richardson level 3 REST. So, you know, all the status codes for whether people were on holiday. So all the, you know, the parts on the board where people are on holiday, they were all HTTP status codes. So if someone rolled off the project, you know, their avatar would move into the 410 gone kind of, you know, kind of like the area of the board, all those sorts of things that makes actually what we do fun. And that's you know, and I have zero time for folk who say that work shouldn't be fun. And at work, what we do is the most privileged thing I think we can do. You know, it's using our brains, turning and creating this amazing sort of stuff from nothing, essentially. And it should be fun. You know, so trying to recreate that environment, I think, is the important thing.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the advice. So one thing that, so as you wrote that article together with Martin, and as you did that presentation, I think there is an interesting quote, or maybe it's a title of a talk by Sam Newman, who wrote that book about microservices, obviously also a former colleague of yours. And he seems to see microservices as a last resort nowadays, which seems to imply that you shouldn't really use microservices unless you really have to. So what's your take on that? Is that an advice that you would give to people too?
So it's so nuanced. I mean, you know, so incidentally, Sam was also on that project, on that program, the Java the Unix Way program. He was the build monkey. We used to call them build monkeys back in the day in ThoughtWorks. He was my DevOpsy person, which is quite funny. It was quite a team we had. So there's a reason. So I'm involved in building the technology radar with ThoughtWorks, Rebecca Parsons, the technology advisory board, as part of that. And there's a reason microservices is stuck in trial. It's never moved into adopt. Whereas adopt is, you know, adopt, we say, this is the sensible default. Adopt is really strong advice from us. We think that all things considered, you should be doing this. And there's a reason it's not moved into adopt. It's because the advice around it is so nuanced, you know. I think, you know, Sam is, I haven't seen that talk, but I can totally sympathize with where Sam's coming from, that it should be something that is a considered option as opposed to being a default option. Well, going all the way back to, again, God, we're going back to that talk a lot. You know, I think even there and ever since, I've tried to emphasize the fact that that microservices really are a set of sensible patterns that have come together, right? So, and then turning them all up to 11. Nothing says you have to forget all the other software architecture patterns, right? Nothing says that because you're using microservices, suddenly all Gregor and Bobby's work on enterprise integration patterns gets thrown away, or that you don't think about you know, different types of you know, event driven versus request response. All these things, you still have to think about all this stuff. And then sometimes when you've got the requirements that point you in the direction of microservices, then it's a good idea to use microservices. There are lots of other times it probably isn't. Saying that, the caveat on the other side is I don't see many projects now that we, and I say projects as a, it's an artifact of working in a consultancy, that aren't microservices actually. Maybe that's because we're doing a lot of things like legacy replacement work. We're doing a lot of more enterprise modernization work, taking bigger, older platforms where, you know, the problems are obvious. They've gotten massive and too big over time. They're doing too much. They've got, you know, they've become like those black holes, you know, black hole systems mm-hmm. where they have their own gravitational field and pull all the functionality into them. So then the natural thing is to say, well, how are we going to break this up? How are we going to take this particular bounded context and implement it as a separate system, as a separate set of services potentially, mm-hmm. so that other people, you know, people can work on them independently from this thing. So as I say, yeah, I do have a lot of sympathy with where Sam's going. And if I was going to build a system from scratch, would I pay the cost of the runway, if you like? So Evan Botcher again, he talks about, you know, the having to build this super long runway for microservices. You've got all the kind of monitoring stuff. You've got all the stuff you need to know: observability, chaos engineering, potentially testing in production. Which isn't 101 software, you know, software development. Do you want to pay that price initially, or is it better off to get something running, earning money, and then evolve it? I think there's also a massive sunk cost fallacy with what we do. There always has been, and that's inherent in the way we fund stuff. Right, we fund things around projects as opposed to products. That's why products, not projects, is one of the microservice characteristics we identified. Because if you think about things as a product, then you should be able to build something, learn more, rebuild it, learn more, rebuild it. That's what product engineering is about, you know. Whereas the kind of project funding model, where you've got a bunch of stuff, you build a thing and it's supposed to be perfect, and then you walk away and leave it, and that's it, and it sits in your books, and you know, 10 years later maybe you turn it off because it's, you know, it's off your books now. That sort of, I think, approach has led to, in some senses, to these questions. Because if you think about building software as an evolutionary process that never finishes, then the idea of starting not with microservices kind of is less of a question, right? Because we can start with one thing, and as I say, when we learn more, we'll break a bit up. But that, as I say, that means the funding has to be available to do that, and the project, product management needs to give the team the capacity to do that, the space to do that, and that often is not the case.
Mm-hmm. So one other thing, so before we started the stream, that you said that you were really interested in flow, and that made me curious. So what kind of flow, what is flow, and why is it so important to you?
So I remember probably back in 2009 again, down north, talking to me about this amazing product management thing called Principles of Product Development Flow, Don Reinertsen, his book. And I sort of read it back then. I thought, well, I mean, it's an extremely difficult book to get through because it's incredibly mathematical in lots of places, and it's quite dense. And at the time, I thought, well, that's interesting, you know. And then I was going to a conference in Australia, Yao, and Don was, you know, seeing the conference. And I thought, oh, well, I'd better read that book again. You know, I'll probably end up sitting next to him at dinner or something. That would be quite embarrassing if I did. So I kind of read, 24 hours straight on the plane over to Australia, read the whole thing, and just it blew my mind. And I think it sort of crystallized so much in my mind about both the benefits of how we've learned to build software in a structured, you know, software engineering way. Is, you know, Dave Farley is very keen on this idea that we're approaching engineering now because we've got repeatable processes around continuous integration, delivery, you know, deploying into production, audit, all security, all that sort of stuff is approaching something that's sort of engineering like. So you've got that on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got this idea of, you know, how do you all the pathologies then of organizations that where everyone's sitting in them going, why does everything take so long to get done, essentially? And for me, the idea of this idea of flow, of the flow of work or ideas or information, really cuts to the heart of both of those things. And continuous delivery, you know, is the, I guess, the epitome of, quote, an agile process in a sense, where you're talking about single piece flow, a piece of work that can move from idea through into production, ideally automatically, but maybe with a button or whatever, you know. You've then got the idea of, you know, of that sort of idealized flow and continuous delivery. You've then got the idea of, you know, kind of flow in how we set teams. So back to Conway's law, you know, why are platform product engineering teams a good idea, for example? Why is AWS and self-service cloud such a great idea? Because it's about flow. It's about having enough, you know, the ability within a single team to get everything done that you need to get done, without having to ask someone else and interrupt the flow of work through to production. You know, that's, you know, the idea that you invert control. You know, a platform team offers a self-service way of giving you of getting stuff yourself. Mm-hmm. Means that you don't have to put a ticket in a queue, which means, you know, you don't have to have a bunch of people that are sitting there servicing tickets in the queue, which means you're not waiting for a long time until someone serviced that ticket and then you've got the thing you want. Yeah, which impedes flow. So I don't know. The whole thing for me, it's these days, I tend to think solely in terms of improving flow, improving flow from ideas into production, improving flow from, you know, goods. Yeah, from raw materials into products, improving flow from, like we're having terrible problems in the UK at the moment, the flow of goods through our borders, right? So, I mean, it's who'd have thought if you don't have, you know, any, if you don't have any, the ability to move goods around, that you'd end up with no food on the shelves? Well, turns out that's what happens, right? If you don't think about flow. So, for me, it's, mm-hmm. it's essentially all about flow.
And I think that's quite interesting, and it's related to Lean, I guess. And Lean is also sort of the origin of Agile, so it all comes together, I guess, at one point.
It's, I mean, for me, Agile, right? You can I've come to describe Agile in three phrases, or three phrases. It's small batches, which is about flow. Right, it's fast feedback and it's discipline. Those are that's agile, right? If you have those three things, then you're being agile, I think.
Yeah, probably we should come up with a new agile manifesto, right? That talks about those three things. And I would actually agree a lot. I think that's really the fundamental foundation. So we have a few minutes left, and there is actually a question on the chat. So, and that's quite a different question. So, Mivo on YouTube asks, are you suggesting that every developer should know AWS? I feel like in most cases, there is always special people roles at companies that do most of the cloud configuration.
I'm not suggesting every developer needs to know, by extension, by every developer needs to know everything. What I'm suggesting is that in order to get stuff done most effectively, most efficiently for flow, then you need to have the things you need within a team to get that stuff done. So, you know, not that everyone needs to be able to configure to be able to write Helm charts or whatever, but it helps if you've got someone who can write Helm charts that's sitting 2 foot away from you, or is a Slack channel away, Slack message away, in order to, you know, rather than have to submit a ticket to the ops team where all the people who write Helm charts live, and, you know, because that essentially acts as a MNQ, right? So you've got Jira tickets with, I'd like a Helm chart, please. I'd like another Helm chart. I'd like another, and you've got four people on this end. You've got four people servicing those tickets. That's as fast as you go, right? Whereas if you can write it yourself, you remove that constraint. So no, not everyone needs to know everything, clearly. But if you've got enough, if you've got people who have got a broader range of skills, then that's very useful, I think.
So there is a follow-up question or comment, and he said that's related to self-contained teams. So maybe as a follow-up question, so would you suggest that in every team there should be someone who knows AWS or Helm charts in your example, or would it be enough to have some experts?
Well, so this comes back to how do you solve for limited resource, right? So, you know, there's a bunch of people you tend to have that are like that. So you've got your security people who, you know, everyone should have a base level understanding around security, but not everyone is going to be able to do, you know, really good threat modeling sessions, for example, or will know the ins and outs of current attack vectors and blah, 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 blah. they're going to be constrained resources. Similarly, with the people who are deep experts in, say, Kubernetes configuration or, heaven forbid, ZooKeeper, you know, those are going to be constrained resources. The best way I've found to manage that, again, is to kind of invert the model. Don't raise a ticket, in a sense. Have those people out as consultants to the rest of the organization, whether they're working, you know, at the start of a project to help something to set stuff up and then check in, or whether they are, you know, on a part-time basis on a regular cadence. Again, cadence improves flow, checking in with teams over time. But I mean, in an ideal world, everyone could do everything. Turns out, you know, it's life is not a computer RPG, right? We can't all have all the skills and level them up over time.
Yeah, probably that's important to realize that. So thanks a lot for being here. We will take a few minutes break. So we will be back at 6:35 p.m. And then my colleague Lisa will talk to Fedin Hermans, another speaker from the Software Architecture Gathering. So thanks again for being here. Thanks a lot for the discussion. And I hope you have a great evening over in the UK, and I hope to see you soon again somewhere at some conference or wherever. Okay.
Yeah. So. Thank you very much. And Feline's amazing, so I'm going to log in for that, I think.
Okay, great. Looking forward to it.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.